Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You know, you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome now Jonathan Cohn. He's joining us by phone. He's senior editor at the New Republic and author of the new book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price, published by HarperCollins. Welcome, Jonathan, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, everybody knows that there's millions of Americans without health insurance, but as you point out in your book, there's a prevailing idea that there really is a safety net when people are in trouble. What's the truth of that?
Well, I mean, there is a safety net. There are emergency rooms and there are private charity hospitals. The problems, there's sort of three problems. The first is that in order to get seen in this safety net, you really have to be in a pretty urgent situation. There's a federal law that says an emergency room cannot turn you away if you need stabilizing care, but you really have to need stabilizing care. If you just show up in an emergency room and want a checkup, well, they won't give it to you. So what tends to happen is that people don't get the preventative care they need. They don't get the routine care they need. And then, of course, once that is done, they end up with a real emergency. And then first they have a real problem that's going to cost a great deal of money to take care of. And that's sort of the first part. The second part of it is that once people do get treatment in a hospital, if they don't have health insurance, well, the hospitals will often expect to be paid, and they'll be expected to be paid a lot of money. And so you get into this situation where people who don't have health insurance and probably in many cases don't have a great deal of money or certainly not enough to pay out of pocket a five-figure hospital bill find themselves being hounded by collection agents and running up very huge debts. And this is one of the reasons why medical debt has become one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in this country. So it's simply not true that there's a safety net for everybody. There are various programs, there are hospitals, and they catch some of the people falling through, but they do an incomplete job. They don't catch everybody. Some people simply do fall through the cracks. There are people who never make it to the emergency room. There are people who never get the health care they need. And then even when they do, they end up with a serious financial problem because of it. So, you know, if it's a safety net, it's got an awful lot of holes in it.
You open the book painting a picture of the emergency room problem, and because the emergency room tends to be, as you just said, the place where a lot of people go because they don't have any other options, emergency rooms are incredibly overcrowded, and there are people dying in emergency rooms, dying in ambulances, waiting outside to go in. What's going on there? Is it because of the thing you just said? That's all that a lot of people have?
Well, yeah, the problem with our emergency rooms, there's both, there's an easiest way to explain it is there's an input problem and there's an output problem. Now, the input problem is the fact that you have all of these people who are uninsured, and it is the number of people without health insurance is growing, both in raw numbers, but also as a percentage of the population. And plus, you have people who have health insurance but can't afford their co-payments, can't afford their cost-sharing, so they don't have a place to go either. Well, when these people need medical care, they show up at the emergency room, and that crowds the emergency room. So that's the input side. The output side, which is a little more complicated, is that during the 1990s, the hospital industry was under a lot of pressure to become more competitive, to act more like a business. Now, the reason for this was cited was that there was a lot of inefficiency in our hospital system, and that was true. There was a great deal of inefficiency. Unfortunately, the way hospitals reacted when they were told to act like a business was they did what businesses do. They thought, well, where are we losing money? Where are we making money? And they concentrated on expanding those portions of their facilities that made money, which tended to be the very high-fee, expensive specialty surgical units. And they cut back on those areas where they tended to lose money. The classic example of this was psychiatry. They didn't tend to make a lot of money on psychiatry beds, so they downsized those or they closed those altogether. Well, here's the problem. In the emergency room, you get a lot of people who need admission into the hospital, and a lot of them need admission into places like psychiatry or maybe to various internal medicine departments. They tend to need admission into the areas of the hospital that don't make a lot of money. So as those areas got shrunk, emergency rooms found themselves in a situation where they could process people fast enough. Even if they could handle the mass of people coming in their door, well, then they had no place to put these people. And in fact, if you walk around an emergency room or you talk to people who run emergency rooms, they will tell you the big problem is this phenomenon, which they call boarding, which is a fancy word for saying sticking people on gurneys while you're waiting for a room to open up upstairs. So you end up with this huge backlog, and you have people waiting to get treated, and then once they do get treated, you have them waiting to get admitted to the hospital. And you have people who are very, very sick and a lot of discomfort, sitting in conditions with, frankly, no privacy. And if you go to a big city emergency room, you'll see this. All you have to do is walk around. And it starts to actually resemble, I don't want to say third world conditions, but it certainly doesn't resemble, I think, what most Americans would associate with good, clean, up-to-date, top-of-the-line American health care. And the end result is that it's inconvenient for a lot of people. A lot of people do suffer. Most physicians and nurses and health professionals who work in these facilities will tell you they think it's having adverse outcomes, it's leading to adverse outcomes for their patients. And, of course, sometimes when emergency rooms get this crowded, they have to close. And they go on what's called diversion, which means they divert people coming to them to other hospitals. This happens all the time in big city hospitals. And there are stories of people, as like the one I opened my book with, of somebody who was in critical condition, was diverted to another hospital, and at the end of the day died, and quite possibly might have lived if they'd been able to go to the hospital where they were originally intended to go.
You point out, just by saying what you've told us now, one of the, I think, major flaws in using a market model for delivering health care, because this is not a place where people are making rational choices. Gee, I think I'll take this, I think I'll take that, and providers are responding with what patients need. What patients need is not necessarily what's available, and that it's just a gigantic disconnect between how the system works and what the needs are.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you pay attention to politics, you know that for a few years now, as it's become apparent that we have a healthcare problem in this country again, we sort of stopped talking about these systematic problems after the 1994 battle over the Clinton healthcare plan. I think everybody's had a hangover from that fight. The problems didn't go away so much as, I mean, they did sort of, they seemed to go away for a while, but they were still there, and now they're back in full force. And so you have a situation where, for the last few years, people are starting to talk about this again. Conservatives have said over and over again, well, the solution to this is to unleash the market, let consumers have more choices, let them do more shopping around, and this will solve all of our problems. As you unleash the market, consumers will find the best health care, and their bargaining pressure will bring down prices. And the most recent person to be walking around saying this is Rudy Giuliani, who's running for president. He has been running around on the campaign trail saying this is what we need to do. Well, you know, if you just think about it, I mean, this is not so complicated. I think anybody who's been sick can think through the problem with this. You know, on the one hand, sure, it's great for us all to be smart consumers and to learn more about our medical conditions and, you know, have a little skepticism and apply a little scrutiny to the treatments we're recommended. But, you know, there is a reason physicians go to medical school for 4 years after 4 years of college and then continue to go through several years of residency and training, and why nurses go through the training they do and why health professionals learn all this. It's very complicated. It's very difficult to make an informed decision if you don't have all that training. And at the same time, you're often not in a condition where you can make that. I mean, right. You know, it's lovely to say that, gee, you know, the conservatives will often cite the example of LASIK surgery. They'll say, you know, the LASIK market, they call it the LASIK market, you know, works because people shop around for LASIK surgery. LASIK surgery is the eye surgery you get so you don't have to have glasses anymore. It's laser surgery. Well, LASIK surgery is completely optional. It is completely discretionary. You want to get it because you don't want to wear your glasses anymore. You can take as long as you want shopping around. You can read up as much as you want. You can take forever, and you can decide not to get it. Well, what if you have appendicitis? What if you're having a heart attack? Are you supposed to say, gee, I want to go to this hospital, not that hospital, or gee, I want this treatment and that treatment? You may not be conscious. And that's an extreme example. But even in, say, if you're dealing with cancer, you know, people who have actually gone through this will attest to this, that having a life-threatening disease is an overwhelming experience. It's often accompanied with a great deal of pressure. And to add the sort of burden of having to sort of shop around, I mean, you're being told that, well, you're going to find, we're going to leave this all up to you in terms of finding the best place to go, and you'll know what to do, and that will make your health care better. Well, you know, it's nice to have choice, and we all want choices, and we should have choices. But at the end of the day, don't imagine for a second that most of us are going to be able to intelligently sort of say, aha, well, I know that this hospital does this procedure better, but this one does this procedure better. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Not only that, but there's no way to get the information. I mean, there's the only way you can find out whether a doctor is good or not is word of mouth. There's not institutions that help you make those choices, nor are there for something that one would think there could be a market for, a competitive market for, namely health insurance. It's very hard to know what kind of health insurance to buy, even if you're in the market for it. And as you point out in your book, a lot of insurers don't want to insure people who are even willing to pay the premiums.
Well, that's right. The lack of information is a big problem with this vision for a consumer health society. The experts don't even agree among themselves all the time how we should measure the quality of health care. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try, and that doesn't mean it's not good to have the information out there, and it doesn't mean that there's a demand for that information, we'll see more of it. But at the end of the day, I think we're still pretty far away from having really good, reliable information. And that's true, like you say, even when it comes to shopping around for insurance companies, it becomes very difficult. At least it becomes difficult in the kind of market we have where it's so unregulated and so wide open. It's very difficult to know going in, how does this insurance policy differ from somebody else's? What am I getting? What am I not getting? Aside from the very basic information about cost, what are my premiums going to be? What are my deductibles going to be? What are my co-payments? And even that can be misleading. I mean, if you're not reasonably sophisticated about these things, you may not know to ask certain questions like, does this cost payment cover, when does this, it may be that you generally have a deductible of so much money, but certain things don't count towards the deductible, or there's a higher co-payment for certain kinds of treatments, but you don't know in advance what those are and such. And it is hard to judge. At the very least, you would want a system where somebody was organizing that information for you, saying, look, this is the important information, this is what you need to know, and you would want somebody to come in and say, look, you're going to choose, and I think there are people who like private insurance and think that we should always have private insurance and not government-run insurance, and that's a sort of separate argument, but okay, well, at the very least, then, somebody ought to be in there organizing that insurance market for you so that you can be assured that any insurance policy you pick will cover your basic needs and will not leave you destitute when you suddenly fall ill. Someone ought to be regulating it to make sure that you're not dealing with fraudulent insurers, and that's something else that happens all the time right now. But of course, if you do all of that, even if you're dealing with private insurance, you're still, and eventually you're going to have a government oversight. You're going to have government oversight and a universal healthcare system. So one way or another, I think if you look at the problems of our healthcare system, we're not going to solve them until we get universal healthcare.
We're talking to Jonathan Cohn, author of the book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. On the subject of insurance, there's a very interesting story. The book is an interweaving of individual stories and then historical analysis and analysis of the current situation. And there's a story about a young woman, happily married. Her husband had a good job at a bank, good insurance company. She gets pregnant, has twins prematurely, and suddenly the insurance company at first they pay for everything properly, and then they get cantankerous and don't want to pay for things.
Yeah, one of the great myths out there, I think, one of the reasons people aren't marching in the streets demanding change is the belief that if you have good insurance and you have a good middle class job, or you're married to somebody with a good middle class job, that you're fine. This story is a story of somebody who thought precisely that, as you say, lived in suburban suburb of Austin, Texas, was living a lovely life in this new home in a nice suburb, and then she had these twins prematurely, and now the insurance company covered the birth and labor and the immediate aftercare, which was extremely expensive. They were very premature. They were in the hospital for several months, but once she took her babies home, one of them developed cerebral palsy. And cerebral palsy is the kind of disease that will require, over the course of a lifetime, intense medical treatment. Among other things, it is the recommended treatment for children with cerebral palsy is physical therapy, which is widely believed to help them someday walk. She went to get that therapy. It was recommended to her. She went to the doctors that were approved on her HMO. And then one episode after another, they weren't paying. And first it was they weren't covering certain kinds of therapy. Then it was, they were only covering so many days of therapy. At one point they told her, we are willing to cover 60 days of physical therapy for you, but it has to be 60 consecutive days. And so she found herself thinking, let me get this right, that over the course of the year, my son who needs physical therapy, he can get 60 days of treatment, but it has to be 60 consecutive days. So if he starts on January 1, he can basically go through the end of February. And then after that, he can't get any more physical therapy. Well, that didn't make any sense, obviously.
And I mean, you have the sense that there are people in offices sitting there trying to figure out how not to pay out money.
You do. I mean, you do get the sense, and in fact, in the book, I talk about this. I mean, there is a bureaucracy created to slow down the payment, to apply scrutiny at every level. Now, some of this is good. I mean, there's a rational side to this, which is that there for a long time, frankly, there was no scrutiny applied to any medical treatments, and people were frankly getting too much, which both drove up costs and frankly wasn't good for the patients either. Unfortunately, this was sort of, you know, using a sledgehammer to solve that problem, a very imprecise way to have this sort of create this bureaucracy that was really geared towards simply cutting down on care, in an almost arbitrary way. I mean, there were medical guidelines, and sometimes they did it the right way, but sometimes they didn't. And you look at this, at the way the way these stories, which happened everywhere. I mean, forget the sort of people who sort of denied the life, the life-saving treatment. It's just the general hassle factor, which was widely understood within the industry to just put a brake on spending, because at some point, a lot of people just aren't going to fight it. They just put up with it. Either they just go along and they don't get the treatment, or they pay out of pocket. And you do get the feeling that this was a way that they thought they could save money. And of course, these are for-profit insurance companies, most of them. They want to save money because they want to make money. That's their job. Their job is not to provide good health care. Their job is to make money. If providing good health insurance happens to make them good money, well, then that's fine. But at whatever point that providing good health care no longer makes them money, well, they're not going to do it anymore.
I've often wondered, and the example of the couple who had these premature twins was another example of this. The husband was offered a better job at a higher salary, but when they scrutinized the health plan that was available to the family, it wasn't going to cover anything for these young twins, and he didn't take the new job. And I wonder, what are the consequences on society of having people stay in jobs that they don't like just for the insurance? When someone else could do their job better, they could do another job better. It would be hard to measure this, but do you have any sense of it?
Well, it is hard to measure. I mean, the phenomenon, we call it, in the health policy business, they call it job lock. And it's very difficult to measure. And so the economists will tell you they're not sure how big an effect it is, if at all. But I think what economists would all support is, in general, that our healthcare system is wasteful. Having all of these different insurance companies who are competing on all different measures is wasteful. There is an enormous amount of money just poured down the drain, paying consultants who come into companies to try to tell them how to slice this and that off of their healthcare costs. And then those consultants go and new consultants come in. And there's this constant game being played of who can administer health insurance slightly more cheaply and how can you do it. Sometimes finding cost savings leads you to actually provide more efficient health care, but oftentimes it doesn't. And oftentimes you find you're just wasting money. And there's all sorts of economic effects from this. It's not just the money that is wasted, but as you say, people don't switch jobs. We're supposed to be the country, I always find this ironic, this is the United States, right? We're the country that lionizes entrepreneurship. We are the country of the self-made millionaire. Someone hangs out a shingle, decides to get a job, start a business, and they'll make it on their own, and that's great. Well, of all the countries, and this is what makes us better than every other country, supposedly, right, every other developed country. Well, of all the developed countries I know, we are the only one that tells you if you want to start on your own that we're not going to make sure you have health insurance. You'll have to buy it on your own. And anyone who's been in a small business or been self-employed will tell you that it's much more difficult to find health insurance on your own or in a small business because the insurance system we have is really built around the needs of large employers. And again, that is unique to the United States and don't have this problem in other countries. So somebody who wants to start a business in this country has to think long and hard, am I going to be able to get health insurance? And if they have a pre-existing condition, if they are worried they might hire people with pre-existing conditions, they won't be able to get coverage. And that is a major detriment to entrepreneurship. And it's funny because, I think we associate in this country, there's a lot of people in politics associate the idea of government programs as discouraging people from taking economic risks and being innovative. Well, quite the opposite is true. That this is a case where having the government provide basic health security to people would actually unleash people, would free them to take more risks, to be more entrepreneurial, and actually be more innovative, which in the long run is going to be better for our economy.
Tell us how HMOs and managed care work. What was their promise, and what is the reality that actually came out of it?
Well, you know, it's quite ironic, actually. You know, the fact that everybody hates HMOs today. I mean, nobody likes HMOs. And yet, if you go back in history to their origins in the early 1930s and late 1920s, managed care began as this very idealistic notion of these nonprofit rural medical cooperatives, where you had groups of doctors getting together and saying, look, we live in these farming communities. The people here can't afford to pay our bills. So let's get together and say, look, you pay us a fixed sum of money every month, and we will then provide you with medical care. And we'll run as a cooperative. We will use the money as smartly as we can so we can stretch the dollars as far as it can go, and we'll do it that way. And we'll all work on a salary, and we'll use the money we have to buy the best equipment we can and the best medicine we can. And it turned out that this was a very good way to provide medical care. It was both it was cheaper, but it was also more efficient medically because you had these doctors together talking to each other. There was a lot of teamwork, people, there was a lot of communication. There was continuity of care. In other words, you were in the same place getting care time after time after time. And so this model actually grew, and it became very popular on the West Coast. And at some point, as it grew, organized medicine, the American Medical Association, doctors in private practice, a lot of them did not like this idea because they found, doctors in private practice thought, gee, I like to work for myself, and if this model takes over, I'll have to work for one of these groups, and I don't want to do that. So there was a big fight, and at the end of the day, these group practices, group practice models, as they were called, they sprung up in a few places, but they never spread across the whole country. Well, if you fast forward to the 70s and the 80s, suddenly for the first time, the business community is extremely worried about how much it's paying for its employee health care, and they're desperate for a way to cut down costs. And they say, hey, what about this managed care model? This seems to save money. Can't we get more of our employees into these? Well, suddenly the insurance industry takes notice and says, aha, we'll start offering this same kind of product. And in fact, they actually bought some of the old group practices. And we'll start offering this, and this will save you money. Well, the problem was when commercial insurance took over the group practice model, you know, commercial insurance, this wasn't a bunch of doctors sitting around in a farming community thinking, how can we do right by our patients and come up with a really good, efficient way to promote quality care? This was all about the bottom line. How can we just shave dollars off the premiums? Well, what ended up happening was they didn't do the quality part. They didn't focus on making healthcare better. They didn't focus on communication. They didn't focus on helping to do a lot of preventative care. They did some of this, but not nearly as much as you would have hoped. In the meantime, they just cut costs, and oftentimes, again, going back to our story in Texas, they did it in arbitrary ways. And so you ended up with this situation where managed care, which had started out as this very idealistic effort to make medical care both better and cheaper, simply became an exercise in making it cheaper, which, you know, was not a bad thing. I mean, when health insurance is cheaper, it's easier for us to afford, and our salaries go up, so that's a nice thing. But at the same time, quality actually didn't improve, and people like the couple in Texas, I think, really suffered. And that's why, you know, today people hate HMOs. When if they had evolved in a different direction, I think we'd all be saying, gee, this is a great way to get our medical care.
HMOs, one of the things they do is they give doctors incentives to economize, to order fewer tests, to spend less time with patients. How does this affect doctors, both their job performance and their liability?
Well, you know, again, you know, it depends on how you're organizing it. I think, you know, giving doctors incentive to be to not order extra tests that aren't necessary is probably a good thing. You know, the old rural cooperative, these old group practices, and generally paid doctors on a salary. And the idea was that, look, you know, you do more, you do less, you're going to get paid the same. Just do what's good for your patient. And they tended to have time with their patients, too. I mean, that was something that was good, and you got to spend time with your patients. The problem with the way the HMOs have sort of evolved is they don't do that. It's all about cost saving. You get more incentive for doing more services, for seeing more people rather than more services. So you end up rushing through your medical visits more. And at the same time, you know, you do lose some autonomy. I mean, the funny thing was if you worked in one of these group practices, typically there were these broad guidelines set for how you were supposed to treat people. But you had the freedom to go outside those bounds as long as you could explain it. Well, the way HMOs eventually evolved, again, you had these large insurance companies administering them. And so there were these rules handed down, and everything involved a sort of call to this, you know, this faceless person at some other end of a telephone line who may or may not have been a medical professional and saying, look, I want to do this, this patient needs that, and maybe they, you know, give you a hard time. I mean, just the other day I was speaking to someone who worked in a local emergency room, and he had a patient with an emergency, needed a certain treatment, and called. They said, well, I want to give this medicine, and they say, well, we understand that, but we can't give you approval until tomorrow because, you know, the office is closed. And like, well, we can't wait till tomorrow. They're like, well, just then go ahead and give it. Well, yes, but aren't they going to get charged then? Well, yes, if you give it without us approving it, they'll be charged the full price, which was, you know, several hundred dollars. So, you know, it's crazy. Doctors in the old group practices actually had a fair amount of autonomy. Doctors who today in today's world of managed care, I think, don't have autonomy. And I think that's one of the reasons, interestingly enough, you know, historically, when we talk about universal health care, creating a system that covers everybody, if you go back to the 20s and to the 30s, when this debate first started, physicians were really out in front. They were really the ones who were really fighting this, who were doing their best to keep universal health care from happening. Well, that's changing a little bit now, I tend to think. There's not really good evidence on this, but anecdotally, I can tell you that a lot of physicians are saying, you know what, spent the last 10, 20 years dealing with a private insurance bureaucracy, and frankly, that was not a lot of fun, and maybe having a universal health care system wouldn't be so bad. And in fact, if you go abroad and talk to physicians abroad, you'll find that, you know, the doctors who operate in universal health care systems tend to have more freedom, more clinical freedom. You know, they have less, you know, they don't sit on the phone the way American, you know, typically in the good systems at least, they don't sit on the phone the way American doctors do, arguing with, you know, insurance company bureaucrats hundreds of miles away who, again, may or may not have had the same level of medical training.
We're talking to Jonathan Cohn, author of the book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. When Bill Clinton came into office in, what was it, 92, 93, he had a proposal for healthcare reform which failed. What was the nature of his proposal?
Well, you know, it's funny. People hate the Clinton health care plan, famously. Oh, the Clinton health care plan, it was this terrible, terrible idea. It was a mess. It was botched. I have argued, I actually wrote an article recently arguing this, that in fact if the Clinton health care plan had passed in 1994, we certainly would have been better off today, and we might be much better off today. It was actually a fairly well-designed plan. You know, the premise was they didn't want to get rid of private insurance because that's what was out there already, and they didn't want to change more than they had to. But they wanted to make sure everybody had health insurance. They wanted to give people choices. I actually wanted to expand people's choices. They wanted to give people more choices than they had. They wanted to keep it affordable, and they wanted to encourage the use of better quality medicine. So the system they basically created said that everybody would have gotten to choose from a series of private insurance plans, the same way that if you work for a large company now, you probably choose. You know, if you work for a large company or you're a government employee, typically once a year there's an open enrollment period, and you have a couple of insurance plans to choose from. And, you know, usually they vary in price. And if you want one that's more open-ended, that can let you see any doctor you want anytime you want, you probably have to pay a little more. If you're willing to go with one that restricts your care a little more, it probably costs a little less, although the dirty little secret is that sometimes you actually get better care in those insurance systems. Well, imagine that system, it wasn't only available to people in large companies. Everybody, every American, no matter what their economic status, no matter what their job, no matter where they were, had the same set of choices. That is exactly what the Clinton plan would have done. It would have said once a year you got to make this choice among insurance plans. And they would have, you know, they wouldn't, but it was a set choice of a couple of plans. And the idea was that the government would have made sure that these were all decent, good insurance plans. They all gave you at least a certain minimum level of benefits. They all covered what most people would consider a good menu of services. And they had provisions in there to hold down the cost of medicine so it didn't get so expensive. You know, I think if we had that system today, I think most people would be pretty happy.
There's a lot of terribly sad stories in your book, and we'll get to some of those in a moment, people who were hardworking Americans, you know, doing their best, decent people, good people who got really screwed, and some of them even died from the healthcare crisis. On the other side, somebody's making a whole lot of money. Who's making the money where in the system where so many people are losing out?
Well, you know, CEOs of insurance companies are making a lot of money. Pharmaceutical industry is making a lot of money. There are various health professionals making a good amount of money. Now, I, whether some of these people deserve to make that money or not, I personally don't begrudge anybody making a lot of money. I mean, we live in the United States. Some people are going to make a lot of money. Health professionals, certainly, I'm happy to see doing well. You know, physicians in this country go through an enormous amount of medical training. Many of them end up with huge mounting debts. So I am not one to begrudge them for making a good salary once they finally get a chance to start earning money. But, you know, it's one thing to say physicians making a lot of money because they, you know, they have to pay off their debts or such. It's another thing to say that insurance CEOs have to make, get to make a lot of money. Well, okay, well, what is their contribution? You know, what is the contribution of the American insurance industry? I would argue you're going to be hard-pressed to find one. I mean, there are some innovations they've done, but they are innovations that could have been done, in some cases have been done just as well by nonprofits or by the government. I don't see that the competition among insurance companies makes us better. It doesn't make healthcare better. I don't think it makes healthcare cheaper. And so you have to ask yourself, why is all that money then getting wasted? Why is it? Why are we paying these enormous salaries to the CEOs? And, of course, not just the salaries to the CEOs, but it's the dividends to the stockholders. It's the fact that these are for-profit companies. And you have to ask yourself, is that really, you know, it's one thing, again, if they were adding value, but they don't seem to be adding value. I don't see the value they add. And I would argue that at the very least we need to regulate them in such a way so that they do at least add value. Or maybe better yet, really at some point go to a system where they're not providing insurance anymore, at least not the bulk of it. I'm an advocate of what would be called a single-payer healthcare system where the government was in charge of providing basic medical care in the same way it now provides Medicare to the elderly. And there can still be private insurance as a supplement on top of that. But I think in the long run, that's really the most efficient way to provide health care in this country.
There's some very shocking stories, and one of them was a woman who was a former nun whose job was caretaking for an elderly acquaintance. And she went to the hospital. She was there for 2 days. They charged her $11,000, and she didn't have really two pennies to rub together, and then basically sued her for $11,000. And this turns out to be, and it was a Catholic hospital. She had been a Catholic nun. This turns out to be something that's very common, is hospitals very brutally suing their patients.
Well, right. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the safety net and whether it's adequate. And interestingly enough, this also grew out of the 90s when hospitals were told to act more like businesses. As they were told that, as they were told to be more competitive and to improve their margins, as we call it, they started to look at their bottom line. They said, well, where are we losing money? Aha, we're losing money on the uninsured. People who come in who are uninsured often get taken care of and never pay their bills. And, you know, if there's an opportunity, there's someone to meet it. Collection firms would approach, consultants would approach hospitals and say, look, we can get some of this money back for you. Not a lot, but we can get some. And the hospital said, well, all right, and started contracting this work out to collection agencies. Now, this had happened before, but I think it intensified, it appears, during the last 15, 20 years. And so they do. They stick these collection agencies on people. And it's really quite something remarkable to behold. You know, when I was reporting that chapter, I spent a lot of time in Chicago. That's where the story takes place. And I still remember the first time I saw this. I was up in the courthouse in downtown Chicago where they have the hearings on debt for people who are being sued over bad debt. And it's remarkable. You'd go up there on a Tuesday or a Thursday. I think those were the 2 days they had it. And they would post the docket on outside each courtroom of the cases to be heard that day. And there were just names of, I mean, just hundreds, literally hundreds of cases listed. And every other one was hospital versus somebody, a hospital versus somebody, a hospital versus somebody. It's just extraordinary. And then to hear the conversations going on, because typically the way these cases work, this is not like Law and Order. You don't get a jury hearing, a trial or anything. You appear before the judge. You typically don't have a lawyer. The hospital has a lawyer, and the judge says, go outside and go figure this out. And the hospital lawyer is someone from the collection agency. And you know, it was amazing. Sometimes you would hear these lawyers saying, well, do you have an ATM card? Can we go down? Can we get some cash right now? What are your assets? And these are people who, as you say, don't have two pennies to rub together oftenly. Some of them may not speak English, or they may not have the best education. A lot of these people, frankly, don't know that they have certain rights. That, you know, when you don't have a lot of money, you do have certain rights. You're entitled to have enough money to pay for your food and your house before you have to pay off a hospital bill. And in addition to all that, it turns out that the money these people are being charged is actually higher than people with health insurance, because if you have health insurance, the insurers bargain down the price for you. The analogy I use is it's like going into a car dealership. People with health insurance bargain down that price. People without health insurance are basically being asked to pay the sticker price. Only the sticker price, instead of being $100 or a few thousand dollars higher than what you'd bargain down, it can be 2 to 3 or 4 times as much. So you get people who are uninsured looking at 5, even 6-figure hospital bills that they have no way they can pay. And what ends up happening is they frequently end up giving over whatever money they have, which, frankly, that they would be entitled to keep under the law because they have so little, because these prices are unfair, and because most of these hospitals have charity care programs remember, they're getting tax exemptions for being nonprofit institutions. They're supposed to provide some charity care to the uninsured. Or sometimes they end up getting their wages garnished. So here you have people who are working. Most of these people are working. They have jobs. They're trying to get ahead. And yet, because they got sick and they didn't have health insurance, and they didn't have health insurance because they couldn't afford the health insurance, now suddenly they're really behind the eight ball, that for every paycheck they get, which may only be $200, $300, they're having to give over 50 or 100 of it to the hospital. The story of the nun was interesting because she was kind of a unique lady. She was extremely well-educated. She was a nun. She had a master's degree. And I think she had a sense that something was wrong here, that the prices she was being asked to pay were grossly unfair, that it wasn't she had told them when she got there that she didn't have health insurance and applied for charity care and something had gone wrong, and she shouldn't have had to pay that bill. And particularly since the end, she actually didn't even want to go to the hospital. I mean, she was taken there because it was an emergency, but it turned out not to be an emergency. So she had the wherewithal to fight the story. And in the book chapter, I tell the story of how she kind of walked her way through the legal system, figured out how to fight this bill, and what happened in the end. And it's an interesting story because the case, which is unusual in these cases, she actually fought it and went through several hearings. There was a very long paper trail. So I was able to reconstruct the whole case and all the arguments. And what's, I think, the most remarkable aspect of this is the attitude of the collection agent, which is just tenacious and unrelenting and fighting everything and determined to fight, squeeze some money out of this woman, this former nun who lives in poverty, who has no money. And you have to ask yourself, well, is this really the way we want to be running our healthcare system? I mean, this is kind of silly.
Especially when you think about how much money goes into paying people for collections, how much money goes into denying care. If that money actually went to care, how much of the problem would be alleviated?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the classic example is that, you know, we waste a lot of time dealing with the insurance and payment bureaucracy in this country. There's a famous, if you walk into a hospital billing room, there's a story about, a very famous story about this. If you walk into a hospital billing room in Canada, in a hot Canadian hospital, the first thing you would notice is that it's a fraction of the size of the billing department in an American hospital. And then if you asked a few questions, you would find out, at least this is the story from someone who saw this, was that almost all the people in that Canadian hospital are there because they have to work with American insurance companies. Hospitals have to employ all sorts of people to deal with insurance companies. Doctors have to employ all sorts of people to deal with insurance companies. Employers have to employ all sorts of people to deal with insurance companies and payment. And then you have collection agencies and payment specialists. And there's just an entire industry devoted to pushing money around in our healthcare system. And again, if this were leading to cheaper healthcare, if this was providing better quality medical care, well, all right. But it's not. This is not a bureaucracy that is making us healthier. It is not a bureaucracy that is making us more efficient economically. It is not a bureaucracy that is delivering more affordable health insurance. And, the evidence I cite for this, the McKinsey consulting firm, which is, top walls, blue chip, highly respected part of the, of American capitalism, did a study recently, and they concluded that our system was more wasteful than European universal healthcare systems. They concluded that the profits and the bureaucracy were driving up health care costs without paying off. And now, if they say that, and if this, I don't think anybody would ever accuse McKinsey of leading the communist revolution. If they think universal health care makes more sense, if they think this is one of those areas like Social Security, like the fire department, like the police, like the sewer, the water department, or like the army, where it makes sense to having the government take a leading role in it. If McKinsey thinks that, well, why can't the rest of us think that too?
We're talking to Jonathan Cohn. The urban poor have an even harder time than the burdened middle class. What are the specific links between poverty and poor health?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, if you live in an urban area and you're poor, and you're having to already, you know, you probably don't, there's, you know, you don't have a lot of money, and there's a good chance you don't have health insurance. So you're starting off with that problem. Well, now you add to that problem the fact that your health problems are probably worse, and they're worse for any number of reasons. Housing in poor neighborhoods tends to be in very poor condition. You have a lot of people, a lot of kids growing up in houses that have unsafe levels of lead, environmental hazards, asbestos in the ceilings. They're breathing this in. You have, you know, high number, you know, if you go to a clinic, and I remember talking to a doctor at a clinic in South Central Los Angeles, and he was telling me about the enormously high number of kids they see with lead poisoning. And, of course, if you know anything about lead poisoning, the effect of lead poisoning at a very young age, and this is from the paint, mostly the paint, you know, lead paint, old lead paint. New houses don't have lead paint in them, but old houses do. And the paint is old, so it chips. The kids eat it. It's very sweet tasting, so they eat it. And it causes brain damage. Well, that's great. So here you have kids who are already starting behind the eight ball. They already don't have a lot of money. Their schools probably aren't that good. And now, you know, they're dealing with cognitive impairment. And how much harder is it going to be for them to get ahead in life because of that? You have, you know, but then, you know, and then this is, I mean, I remember, you know, another thing you hear about, if you go into urban clinics, and it's hard to imagine this, but you can look it up in journals. They talk about this. You know, kids, you know, they're infested with roaches and bugs and mites, and you know, you have kids showing up in the emergency room. They hear a funny sound in their ear because there was a cockroach in their ear, and the doctors have to go through all this to get the bugs out, and that's just the environmental hazard. What about diet? You know, we all now know there's a big push in this country for everybody to live a healthier life, and I think that's great. We should all live healthier lives, and we should eat healthier food, and we should exercise more. Well, you know, again, talk to people who live in these communities. You know, I heard over and over again, well, it's great to say you should eat fresh fruit. Where am I going to buy it? You know, it's not like there's a Whole Foods market on every corner in the middle of South Central Los Angeles. And you know, it's all nice and well to say that, you know, you should exercise, and exercise is great, but I remember very vividly speaking to a woman who worked as a housekeeper at a hotel in Los Angeles, and she didn't let her kids out at night, you know, out, and they didn't get home till about 5, and she wouldn't let her kids outside to run around. Why not? Well, because, you know, sometimes kids got shot outside. Well, okay, you know, that makes sense. I can understand that. But, of course, if you have kids who are not, you know, eating the best food, and they're sitting around in their house breathing these environmental hazards, well, you know, they're going to turn out unhealthy. And that's not even going to the number of people who work in jobs that might be hazardous and such. So, you know, the health effects. And then, of course, now you don't have health insurance, so you're probably not getting preventative health care. So you're not getting, you know, as you get medical conditions, you're not getting the proper checkups. And even things, you know, like, you know, this is often underappreciated, but, you know, the role of dental care. You have an enormous number of kids who aren't getting proper dental care, and that's very painful. I mean, quite apart from the fact that it can lead to actually serious medical consequences. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, kids, they miss school because they're in such pain. And again, you know, you think, well, what do you want to do for a child growing up in a poor urban community? And if nothing else, you want them to get a good education, because that's how they're going to hopefully, if they're going to have a chance of lifting themselves up out of poverty, that's what's going to do it, is the education. Well, you're now saddling them with poor health that keeps them out of school, that potentially gives them brain damage. I mean, you know, again, this is, you know, is this the kind of healthcare system we want? Well, you know, a healthcare system won't solve all those problems, but it can certainly help them.
We're talking to Jonathan Cohn. My taxes and yours go toward paying the health insurance of our senators and representatives in Washington. What kind of health insurance do they have, and why don't we have it?
Well, they have very good health insurance. There's something called the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan. I have to remember. Always remember if I'm getting that right. The acronym is a funny one. And basically, they, as we were talking about before, they have a choice of a number of different private insurance plans. But it's a regulated system, so all the plans provide good benefits. They all will cover most of what they need. And in fact, you know, a lot of the politicians who talk about universal health care, they often try to build it around that. You know, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has been promoting a plan for a while that's, I think, a very interesting plan and a very worthwhile plan. And he sells it as, I'm one to give everybody the insurance I have. He says, I have great health insurance. I have federal employee health insurance. I want to give you that insurance, too. I want to create a system where everybody can get the insurance that members of Congress can get. And really, the Clinton plan, that was the basic premise there as well. And if you look at some of the plans that are being proposed by Democrats who are running for president, they tend to talk about that as well. When you hear people talking about universal health care, if they're talking about a system with private insurance, if it's a good system, and you have to look at it carefully because there's a lot, the details can make a big difference. But if it's a good system, generally speaking, what they're talking about doing is giving everybody the kind of insurance that members of Congress have. Now, why don't we have that? Well, why don't we have universal health care? Well, it's a complicated story. That you have special interests that fight it. You have pharmaceutical industry that doesn't like it. You have small businesses. Small businesses, many of them would actually benefit from it, but a lot of the lobbyists in Washington still don't like it. People who think, oh my goodness, government does everything wrong. We can't have the government more involved. They think, well, even though in fact most of the evidence suggests that government does health insurance better than the private sector. Some people say, well, I don't want to pay more in taxes because the government is going to be involved in universal health care. You will have to pay more in taxes. Well, but the flip side is you don't pay as much in private insurance premiums, and most people should in the long run end up better off financially for that. And I think at the end of the day, the real reason is, again, back to what we talked about at the very beginning. I don't think a lot of people have necessarily felt that vulnerable yet. I don't think people feel that insecure. I think they know that there are millions of people on health insurance, but they figure they can't be one of those people. They know that sometimes not having health insurance isn't the greatest thing, but they think, well, everybody gets the medical care that they need. And that's just wrong, and that's really what my book was all about. If there was one point I wanted to make, was that this could be you. Don't assume that just because you're middle class and you have a middle class job, this couldn't happen to you. And don't think that if it does happen to you, you'll be all right, because you might not be. And the stories in my book, The Eight Characters, I assure you, most of those people did not think this could happen to them, and they didn't envision such bad things happening. But at the end of the day, it did.
And there were also people who didn't want to take anything from the system, and some of them even failed to apply for public assistance when they were eligible for it because they were the kind of people who didn't believe in taking handouts.
Well, that's right. I mean, again, we have a crazy system here. I mean, it'd be one thing to say that, gee, we don't want to give people handouts and people should have to work and earn health security. Well, that would be all fine and well and good, but it doesn't even work that way. I mean, it's not the case that people who work and try hard to get health insurance. Actually, it's those people who end up the worst off. I mean, if you apply for public assistance, you can sometimes get onto a state program. But if you lose your job and lose your insurance, and again, this is you may have been thinking of the first chapter of the book, and there's a family there where the breadwinner, he loses an engineering job at a defense contractor. So he could have applied for public assistance, and had he applied for public assistance, it's quite possible at least his wife and his children would have been put on the state Medicaid program. But he wasn't the type to – he didn't want to go on welfare. He didn't want to be on the lam, on the dole. So he went ahead and he got part-time and temporary work, and he worked more hours than he did, frankly, when he was working at his full-time job. But, of course, when you have part-time work or temporary work, you don't get health insurance benefits. So his family ended up without them.
Jonathan Cohn, unfortunately, it's time to go. We could talk for another hour about your marvelous book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Thank you so much for joining us on KSFR.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This has been a good interview.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. We're archived a couple of months back now. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Stay tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Ciao.